thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
Geeky thoughts.
Here's John Williams.
Sometimes I think geeky thoughts. Are you a geek for something? And what is it? This is John. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio. And I wouldn't say I'm a geek for the Apollo missions, but boy, it's hard not to kind of get wrapped up in Apollo fever these days. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio till 3. Thanks for tuning in. Don Kleppen's probably the kind of guy who would be into that. Klepp, you still got your headphones on over there in the newsroom?
And I do.
And I don't know you that well, but you and I have been working together on Saturdays for a very long time.
It's been great.
And I don't know if we're going to get to anymore, but it's always a pleasure to talk to you. So are you kind of an Apollo guy?
I wish I could say I knew more about it, but I am enthused by it. I think it's exciting.
Well, I've been listening to a lot of the audio today in advance of today's show, Saturday's show, and then a show next week, because as I was talking to Steve, well, the launch was tomorrow. This will be our last show before the launch. So looking at the launch, we do that today. Then Saturday, we'll look at the landing. And then next week when it landed back on Earth, the splashdown. And when you listen to that audio, the men's voices you hear, there were some women involved in the program, too few perhaps, but it was these men's voices you're listening to. They are so cool and calm and collected, and they seem so smart, and this had never been done before. And so from the launch through the landing, all of it, you never hear any of them going, oh, what's that blinking light? Oh! You don't hear any of that. And when you also consider that, remember when there was a thing called a pocket calculator? I remember we used to talk about the fact that the Apollo mission was operating on less power than your pocket calculator had, that they were still using slide rules to figure some things out. And you don't even know what a slide rule is anymore, but that was a thing. And they put a man on the moon. And as they're backing that spaceship down and then flipping it over and landing it on those legs, you just think, this is amazing. This is just so amazing. Never been done before. So we'll visit with Vula Saridakis, who I spoke to off the air and is just delightful and so informed. She's the resident space expert at the Museum of Science and Industry a little after 1:35. Of course, we'd have an expert in Chicago or two, and she's very good on this at 1:35. Bud Selig's got a book out about baseball, former commissioner for the good of the game. He was a commissioner of baseball during maybe its most controversial era. He talks to us about all of that a little after 2 o'clock, and it's Amazon Prime Day. Whoop, whoop. Some of the deals you might want to know about at 2:35. See, Bertrand's back into the news booth now. Steve had a lovely weekend in Milwaukee.
I did, yeah.
I think you should tell people what you did, because I'll save it for Bud. Here. Yeah, I know, really, we have this Milwaukee connection here today on the show.
Well, we just wanted to go for a walk along the lake or something, and Milwaukee is such a nice lakefront. It's like a 3-mile trail, and we just did that. You know, we could have come into a neighborhood in the city, which would have been great too, but it was about the same to go north as it was to go south, so why not check out Milwaukee? Had a nice little lunch in the Third Ward. Good time.
You live in the north side of the city. Or you
in the suburbs.
North suburbs
right.
Of the city, yeah. So for a lot of you, going to Milwaukee is as easy as getting to Grant Park.
And you asked me where I parked. I'm like, across the street from the lake.
He looked at me like I'd asked the dumbest question, because I said, where did you park?
Right. It's literally, I mean, they were just up and down the street just parking on the beach.
Chicago, not so much.
Nah, not so much.
Especially this weekend. It was crowded in our little city.
Yeah. Well, we had a great time in Milwaukee.
And then on the friends of mine went up to the Cubs game yesterday, so they're taking the Stevenson from the Joliet-Manuka area. They're coming up I-55, and the Stevenson was closed for a lot of the weekend because of that terrible truck crash. It was closed for hours. It was closed overnight. If you were coming up to the Cubs game from the south, you had to get off at Cicero and then go over on 47th and then come back down around. And then, you know, there's Taste of Chicago. Steve, you're just going to have to endure for the rest of my duration at this radio station every summer my micro rant that we are over-festivaled in Chicago.
Yeah, you just wanted to be the last one in. I understand that.
Now that I live in the city,
NIMBY,
I don't want any more stuff. And in fact, I think we should pull back on some of our stuff.
There's only one. Usually during the Taste of Chicago, there's only one festival going on, right?
Well,
they don't have other little neighborhood festivals.
Roscoe Village, I think, had a hamburger festival something like that. But the point is, say for the week that they're setting up for doing Lollapalooza, say for the 2 weeks that they're setting up for doing Taste of Chicago, if you want to go to Grant Park or Millennium Park or any of those areas, it's different looking. They've got all of these scaffolds up and all of these fences up. It's not as easy to move around. It's just not as pretty. Grant Park, Millennium Park, the lakefront are so nice that we don't need to mess them up. We don't need to do more stuff there. Just show up. There it is. It's all you need. We don't need a hamburger thing there.
Yeah, you really do sound like a curmudgeon. You got to get, enjoy it. It's summer. You've got 3 weeks.
Yeah. I have to tell you about the president's tweets. Everybody's talking about them this weekend and today, that I am not as outraged by them as maybe I should be. I think I'm one of those people who's been so beat down by it that when I first saw them prior to the reaction, I thought, well, there he goes again. And I think today is, even by Trump standards, an extraordinary day for his Twitter account. People are very upset about what he said. And I was maybe not ready to put this in the same box as you don't need to worry about that. But I didn't think this was going to upset people the way it did, because this is Trump 101. So interesting to see progressive Democratic congresswomen who originally came from countries whose governments are a complete and total catastrophe, the worst, most corrupt and inept anywhere in the world, if they even have a functioning government at all, now loudly and viciously telling the people of the United States, the greatest and most powerful nation on earth, how government is to be run. Why don't they go back and help fix the totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came, then come back and show us how it is done? These places need your help badly. You can't leave fast enough. I'm sure that Nancy Pelosi would be very happy to quickly work out free travel arrangements! The president tweeted over the weekend. He's talking about four women, and Don just told you in the news, members of Congress, all of them U.S. citizens, three of them born here.
One of them came as a refugee, right?
Yeah. And he says, go back and help fix the totally broken places from which they came. To me, this sounds like the United States, love it or leave it. This is Trump's version of that. And I think it's a terrible thing. I hate it. I hate to hear it. It's amazing that the president of the United States says that about members of Congress. But nothing is too extraordinary these days. It's just, I saw it and I went, there he goes.
Yeah, but if you just shrug your shoulders and say this is him being him, then you're part of the problem, I think. Yeah. Because this is, go back to your own country. Is that you don't say that about other white people. You don't tell anyone to go back to Switzerland or Italy.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it was stupid because it's their country anyway. They're in the Congress. So I guess he's saying go back to the country where your people are from. I mean, I shouldn't even microanalyze it like that, right? But I don't know what your reaction to that was. Were you outraged? And by the way, I think there's a population of people that say, yeah, I think part of the, one of the other factors in this is that they're all strident freshmen congresswomen who really want to exact change right now. And some of them are making their mistakes out loud and some of them are making great points. I think we are empowering, particularly Ocasio-Cortez, far more than she is powerful. She's sort of painting the Democratic Party, or the media is painting the Democratic Party with her. And that's not true. She's not a reflection of the Democratic Party. She's a reflection of her own views and maybe her constituents. And the same with the other three congresswomen.
What was it Pelosi said? I'm going to make it up. It was something like I could get a desk chair elected in her district.
I didn't hear that, but okay.
Because
I believe that.
Ocasio-Cortez, she had a primary upset. It was a big upset in New York, but now once you win the primary, and this is how we talk about redistricting, once you win the primary in that district, you could run a desk chair and as a Democrat, and the Democrat would win. So when Ocasio-Cortez is saying things that are unpalatable to most Democrats or much of the country because it's so far left, you know, she's got the cover of a district where she will always be reelected. Other Democrats don't have that cover.
Unless somebody beats her in the primary, yeah. But a Democrat's going to win there, like Chicago. And she is kind of an example of where I am on the president in that I don't seem to be as animated by what the president said as I should be, but I also am not that interested in what she has to say. She's one congresswoman, and she's not mine. And I think she's only as powerful as people make her. She'll always only be one vote in the Congress.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'm not that interested in what she has. I mean, I'm not interested, but right, she's a first term. She hasn't served a full year yet. And she's a darling of the media in some ways, like Anthony Weiner was.
Well, I think she's a darling of Fox News because she's very easy to take her extreme agenda and say, this is how Democrats are. And then if you only focus on her, now you're painting the Democrats with that brush.
I think when she first got elected, she was a darling just about everywhere.
Well, it doesn't hurt that she's attractive. It doesn't hurt that she's fun and that she's savvy on social media, right? I mean, she's and that she represents a group of people who have never seen something like that in the Congress before. So those are all good things. But she, you know, she has the same vote that Nancy Pelosi does, or Raja Krishnamurthy does, or any of the other members of Congress do. My number is 312-981-7200 if you want to say hi. And then the president says today, with no significant pushback, they owe me an apology. I don't know where all the Republicans are, but if you are a member of Congress and you're a Republican, I think I'm right about this. You could criticize the president. You could say he shouldn't have said that, and you will still get reelected. Yes, you can stand up and say that. Give it a try. See what happens. Just take a chance. If you're a Republican member of Congress, just stand somewhere and go, you know, I really wish he shouldn't have said that. That's a terrible racist thing to say. They're good Americans. They got elected. They're part of the system, and we shouldn't be saying that about them. Just try it. See what'll happen. I'll bet even you will get reelected. The Sox get in the ring with their division rivals in Kansas City. This fight's guaranteed to go 9. Could go 10. White Sox, Royals, tonight at 7 on WGN-TV. Boy, this weekend was really what baseball might be like in the second half in Chicago, right? The Cubs are back. And the same day that the Cubs put up 7 in the first inning, the Sox gave up 7 in the first inning. Sox have been having a nice run.
Hey, in all fairness, we just don't play well in Oakland. It's
yeah, that's
curse.
Weird. We can't seem to win a game there.
It really is. It's a weird, like, curse.
I was watching the scoreboard, though. We were watching the Cubs game. Watching the Cubs game from outside Wrigley Field on the jumbo board. And then I was like, well, what's the Sox score? What's the Sox score? Finally, I found the Sox score. And I thought, well, that's weird. We gave up 7, and they got 7. I'm not saying it's all going to be like that, but it'll probably be more like this. The White Sox are a below 500 team that's going to be real good next year and the year after. And the Cubs are a playoff-bound team. And let's see how good they can be. Or this text said, hey, John, when are we going to return the Statue of Liberty to France? It seems kind of silly to keep it. John wanted to say something. You're on WGN. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Thank you, John. I listened to you for years. I missed you when you were gone. I'm 2 weeks short of my 90th birthday. And I remember the newsreels of the 30s and 40s. I come to the conclusion if you like Trump, you'd absolutely love Hitler and Mussolini. They are so un-American, I can't hardly stand them. The Republicans in the House, I can't understand why they don't rebel against this guy.
I don't have an answer for that either. And I think I know why they don't regularly. Thank you for the call. Thank you for listening, John. I know why they don't regularly, because Trump's powerful and it seems to be the standard bearer. He is the head of he's a Republican in office. So you don't knock the man on top if you're a Republican. But every now and then he says, let's face it, that we've never had anything like this. Every now and then he says something. And I think if you're a Republican in Congress, you're so used to apologizing for or ignoring him that you forget there are times he says or does things that are so outlandish, even you can stand up against it and you will still be okay. It's okay to just once in a while say, that was a terrible thing. There's a new book out, and it compares it. I haven't read it. I read a long review of it this morning, and it's about Adolf Hitler and his rise to power. And paragraph by paragraph, they talk about how he did it, about how he gave his speeches, about how he was good with media, about who he appealed to and why, about how he would denigrate the other side. And without saying, gee, this is like the current president, it's pretty amazing how much like the current president Hitler was. It's amazing. I'm not going to read it to you now. I don't have it in front of me. You're probably not even surprised to hear that. But when somebody just lays it out in front of you, it really is remarkable. It's 127. A few quick texts into the show. Trump's right on, John. If these women aren't loyal to this country, go back and fix your own country. We don't want you here.
What have they done that was unloyal? That's disloyal. That's the issue.
262 texted in and said, when did it become acceptable for representatives or senators to curse our president? 262 said, I'm a 57-year-old white guy, and this is a very sad time in the USA, talking about the president. 815 said, this president is so bad for this country, it's unbelievable. We get them both ways here on the show. 847 said, John, all citizens in the United States should be outraged by this leadership. I'm still trying to get my head around the Kavanaugh appointment. Two more. John, these women are getting back what they dish out at Trump. They are nasty women. And about Ocasio-Cortez, I said that she's a darling of the media, in part because she's attractive. 219 said, because she's attractive? Really, John? It doesn't work against you. If you're young, if you are attractive, if you're good on social media, yep, that does help make you a media darling.
The target for the Apollo 11 astronauts, the moon at liftoff, will be at a distance of 218,096 miles away. We're approaching the 60-second mark on the Apollo 11 mission. Our status board indicates that the oxidizer tanks in the second and third stages now have pressurized. We continue to build up pressure in all three stages here at the last minute to prepare it for a liftoff. T-minus 15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence starts. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11. Tower cleared.
We got a roll program.
Neil Armstrong reporting the roll and pitch program, which puts Apollo 11 on a proper heading, plus 30 seconds.
Roll is complete and the pitch is programming.
Apollo 11, Houston, you're good at 1 minute.
And off they went to the moon. Now, it would be at 8:32 in the morning 50 years ago tomorrow that that took place, that Apollo 11 lifted off. I want to talk about that today, our last show before the launch. And then on Saturday, when they would have landed on the moon, with Vula Seradakis, who is the resident space expert at our Museum of Science and Industry here in Chicago. Vula, this is John. You're on WGN Radio. How are you?
I am good. Thank you.
I don't know if you're like me, but in listening to a lot of that Apollo audio, the communication between the astronauts and mission control, I get goosebumps all the time.
Absolutely. I think a lot of people get goosebumps. It was truly a historic mission.
50 years ago, yeah, tomorrow morning was when the liftoff took place. Let's just talk a little bit about that. Was that not an area of great concern of theirs? Was the launch pretty much a sure thing?
Well, nothing was 100% sure, but there were plenty of tests and previous Apollo missions in which they tested everything, and they really tried to make sure that there weren't be any surprises. But anything's possible, but fortunately, this was a huge success, a very successful mission in the end. And as you said, tomorrow morning marks that historic 50th anniversary of the launch, which was the space flight that first landed humans on the moon.
I wonder if people today, say you're under the age of 50 and don't remember that, or under the age of maybe 60 and you don't remember that, but I wonder if we've lost how inspired people were, or how captivated people were by that.
I don't think we have at all. I certainly remember watching it on TV, not live, but many years later after the launch in 1969. And, you know, I and I think so many other, you know, people and children especially are just inspired by watching this over and over again on TV. It truly was just an amazing thing to behold. And in fact, it was estimated that the launch itself was televised on TV to over 30 countries around the world, and millions of people, over, I think about 600 million people watched it and listened in on radio broadcasts. And I think that people who watch it, even today, are just as much inspired today as they were in the past when they watched it live.
1969 was a troubled year in the United States. It's interesting that the world was consuming America two different ways, right? They saw the worst of us, and they also saw the very best of humanity. I mean, look at what mankind can do, and look at all of the strife that we had in the streets the same summer.
Absolutely. That was one of the things that was going on in that time period in American history and in world history, for that matter. But like you said, it truly was inspiring, and it was met with overwhelmingly positive reaction from people around the globe. And it truly, I think, brought a lot of people together in the end.
I think it did, although I think it's also just worth noting. It's not something I need to dwell on now, but at the time, you know, you look back and you go, yeah, everybody was rah-rah, we were all for the space race. We weren't. As a society, the people in the United States were split about whether or not it was a good investment in going to the moon, as opposed to, say, spending money on cities or solving some of the problems that people were rioting about in the 1960s.
Well, yeah, and there were criticisms in the late 60s and criticisms directed at NASA for sure. But, you know, the social and politics point aside, I think it really, really, like we said earlier, brought a lot of people together in the end and demonstrated what we could accomplish as humans, and truly was an inspiration for future space travel.
You know, looking at some of the charts and graphs about it, too, I was always amazed that there were sort of three components: the rocket that sent it up, then the command module, which serviced the landing module. But there were these three parts that that all needed to work together and flawlessly for this thing to be successful.
Absolutely, and it seemed like a very complicated process, but it really all worked very nicely together, and it was successful in the end. So, you know, what they had to do was something called the transposition docking and extraction maneuver after they orbited the Earth about 1.5 orbits, and they started heading towards the moon. They had to do this complicated maneuver, which means separating out the command module, which in Apollo 11 was called Columbia, from the rocket. They had to turn Columbia around about 180 degrees and then dock Columbia with the Eagle, which was the name of the lunar module. And then this is the combined spacecraft that eventually traveled to the moon. But it all worked flawlessly in the end.
Yeah. Almost flawlessly. And you look at that and you go, well, wait a minute, there's got to be a better way to do that. I mean, if you were just starting from scratch, and they did, and you said, how do we get a guy on the moon?
Yeah.
Well, we'll blast him into space. But we need a giant rocket for that that's not going to go to the moon, so we'll dispose of that. I get that. But then you'd think it would all just be one piece that would go to the moon and come back. But I guess that was still too large a component to land on the moon and blast off, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they before the Apollo, even Apollo 11, they were trying to figure out what was the best way to get these astronauts to the moon, and should we just use one rocket and one spacecraft, or do it in a combined maneuver and process like the one they decided on? And in the end, that's what they decided, because it seemed that would lead to success for the mission.
So how did it go? They lift off and then they went around the Earth a few times, right?
Right. So about 12 or so minutes into the flight, Apollo 11 entered Earth's orbit, and again, it went around the Earth about 1.5 orbits, after which they fired the engines, to enter what's known as a translunar ejection burn, and that would then have them heading towards the moon. And then after 30 minutes of that is when they did this maneuver that I mentioned, the transposition docking and extraction maneuver. And after they did that, the combined spacecraft is what eventually headed to the moon, and that took approximately 3 days for them to get to the moon. And during the travel over to the moon, of course, they might have to burn the engines or correct the path in certain small ways, which they did. And they also had, they did another televised shot of the astronauts during that travel to the moon, the 3 days travel to the moon.
Which I guess was unique too, or had we previously seen television from space from astronauts?
Oh yeah, it wasn't the first time. So one of the most famous broadcasts was the Christmas televised broadcast of Apollo 11, or excuse me, Apollo 8 that had happened previously, and there were several of those as well, watched by millions of Americans, I might add. In 68.
These maneuvers that you were talking about where they go around the Earth 1.5 times and then they do this tricky maneuver to reorient the capsules and so forth, was that all happening via automation? Were computers managing all of that, or were guys looking at watches and hitting buttons manually to make all of these things happen?
For the most part, I mean, they were hitting buttons and everything was happening manually. The computers were such that that's what they were meant to do, and everything worked fine. The only problem that was first experienced is when Neil Armstrong went to actually land on the moon with a lunar module, the LEM, and then that's when they had a bit of a problem with the landing there. But otherwise, they used the onboard computer, and everything was working, for the most part, working fine until then.
Yeah, that, and we can talk about this on Saturday when we recollect the landing itself.
But, right.
But are you referring to when the computer was going to land the Eagle on a place that was too rocky, and so then they manually flew it?
That is absolutely correct. It was going to land them in a place that was, you know, just not appropriate for landing. And Neil Armstrong, who had, you know, was a great test pilot and knew what he was doing, and he had to just take it off of auto control, and he put the controls in manual and decided to just land the lunar module himself in a much safer part of the moon.
Which, we've all heard that story, but just think about the kind of courage and confidence and hope that required. I mean, yeah, we don't want to land on the rocks, but the computer, maybe we'll make it, maybe we won't. The computer says we should do it. This is a real-time decision. You're descending. You've got a matter of seconds left. Are you going to fly this thing, buddy? You don't get a second chance. I mean, that's an amazing moment, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an amazing, famous moment. Armstrong simply took over the manual control and began maneuvering that spacecraft forward so it could, you know, skate over the crater and clear the spot behind it. This is about 4 miles or so down from the original planned site. And like you said, he had just seconds to think about it and make the appropriate maneuvers. And it's just incredible. And that's what he was trained for, and that's what he did.
Well, and when I listen back to the audio, I don't even hear them discussing much of that. I don't hear him saying, okay, guys, is it okay? I'm going to fly it on my own. Hello? there was no, you know, am I missing something there?
Well, see, Armstrong, along with all the rest of them, they were veteran test pilots. They remained cool and collected. That's what they were trained to do. Even, you know, as warning alarms blared in their cabin, that's what they were trained to do. That's what they did, and they got the job done.
Yeah, one of the warning, Armstrong was saying, what is that? And they said, yeah, we see it too. And I don't think in real time that he ever got a resolution to what that warning light was as they were landing, right?
I believe the warning light was an auto related to the auto landing program. The auto landing program was about to drop them, like we said before, in the middle of this, you know, area with lots of rocks and boulders. And Armstrong saw that, and that was just wasn't acceptable. And like you said, he had just seconds to make a decision on what to do.
Oh, I see. Okay. So in other words, and we can talk about this again on Saturday, but yeah. We're talking about it now anyway. That's fine. But so as it's descending, he sees this warning light. He's having conversation with them about it, and that warning light is telling them maybe this is a bad place to land. So that conversation, which I thought sounded rather routine, was actually him deciding to now take it and operate it manually, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, everything was happening so fast, it wasn't like he really had a lot of time to explain to them. Back at Mission Control, he was concentrating on the task at hand, so a lot of things were happening in a space of seconds. He had 30 seconds of fuel left in the LEM, so things were going very quickly.
And that's the other thing that just frightens the heck out of me. Both, you know, every element of the journey to the moon and certainly back, you can't go to a gas station or recharge your stuff. If you spend too much time maneuvering the landing vehicle, you're going to run out of gas and you're going to fall to the moon. And if you and boy, you better have enough to get blast back off, too, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, almost every step of the way between launch and splashdown was a nail biter on this mission. So every step of the way, including and especially getting the LEM on the surface of the moon and then the returning back to the command module.
Voulos Aradakis is the resident space expert at the Museum of Science and Industry here in Chicago. So if I go there, I know you guys have, do you still have the big movie up about Apollo 11 or the Apollo missions?
We do. We have, so what we were talking about before, which was that time that Armstrong tried to land on the surface of the moon, and we have that playing around our lunar module trainer. We have that particular artifact in Henry Crown Space Center, and we also have, between now and February, the Apollo 11 film, and that airs four times a day, and that includes never-before-seen footage.
And they have air conditioning there, too, folks. So if you're thinking, I want to find something to do on this summer day or weekend and it's hot outside, go to the Museum of Science and Industry. Nice to talk to you, Vula. Let's visit again later in the week.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Voulos Aradakis is their space expert over at the Museum of Science and Industry. It's 150. 50 years ago today and tomorrow, this is the number one song on the hip-hop charts. Texts into the show today include, John, I remember watching the landing. I was 10 years old when Apollo landed. I remember looking up at the moon, amazed that someone was there. Who among us didn't do that? What a summer that was. 630 says, John, I don't believe we landed on the moon. Nobody knows what it takes to be able to lift off to the moon. Our government lies to us. And speaking of our government, 630, John, let's get a few things clear, says 815. Donald Trump's undeniable similarities to Hitler are not amazing, as you said. They are terrifying. And number two, it's not okay for Republicans to say something every once in a while. It is their moral obligation to say something every time Trump spews more hateful and divisive rhetoric. They are gutless hypocrites, each and every one of them. But 630 said Trump isn't a smooth talker like Obama was, who has been said to be the worst president ever. Trump is a businessman getting things done with all of the BS of most of the politicians. He's the smooth businessman getting things done. By the way, I have not seen the quote-unquote presidential poll that says that Barack Obama was one of the worst ever. You may say that. Your friends may say that. Donald Trump said that. But find me the poll of historians or people that, you know, find me any poll that says that Barack Obama is one of the worst presidents ever and send it to me. Because everyone I've seen, especially the ones that, you know, are from historians, people that study presidents, put him in the top. Depends on the one, but he's up there. And I know you don't like him if you don't like him. And I know you've got it. And you love Donald Trump if you love Donald Trump. But I'm just telling you, I have not seen the poll that puts Barack Obama in the bottom of U.S. presidents. If you have, send it to me because, as I said last week, we've got a big bus here and I got a lot of room, but I just need to see that. So send it to me when you find it. It's
thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
Found it.
Here's John Williams.
The poll, I'll get to that in a second. Hi, it's John. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio. We're here weekdays 1 to 3 and Saturdays 10 to noon. Thanks for tuning in on social media, WGN King John. That's me. We've got a podcast called The Mincing Rascals, judged to be the best in the state. By the Illinois Broadcasters Association. Don't miss Steve Bertrand, Eric Zorn, Scott Stantis, our own Justin Kaufman. Sometimes Kim Gordon. She did a great job for us this past week on The Mincing Rascals. So, you know, I shouldn't go down this rabbit hole, but it just got me wondering, where does Barack Obama rank in the polls? So I went to Wikipedia, and Obama is eligible for polls, obviously not as long as some other presidents, because it wasn't that long ago that he was president. But
are you looking like for rankings or popularity polls, or what are you looking at?
It depends. These are historians. So you've got the Siena poll, the APSA poll, the C-SPAN poll, the APSA poll, etc. I think these are by, well, here, I'll read the beginning of it, Steve. It's on Wikipedia. In political,
so it must be true.
Political studies. Surveys have been conducted to construct historical rankings of the President of the United States. These are based on surveys of academic historians and political scientists or popular opinion. So I'm going to give you both. But just to be clear, because I started to defend Barack Obama as a good president, and then I thought, well, where does he rank? The polls, either with academics or popular opinion or political scientists, have him as the 15th best, the 18th best, the 12th best, the 8th best, or the 17th best. So in the top 25%, 8th is obviously higher than that. The current president is ranked as the 44th best president or the 42nd best president. Before that, you get George Bush, and he's 23, 19, 36, 39, 31, 35 of 45. He's the 33rd, 30th, or 33rd best president. Before that, Bill Clinton is in the low 20s. He ranks as high as 8th in one survey. George Bush, before that, George H.W. Bush is in the 20s and high teens. Ronald Reagan is in the single digits, 8, 8, 10, 8, 11, 9, 9, 13, 18, 20. So of the most recent presidents, nobody is close to Reagan. And then you've got Clinton and Obama. Prior to that, Jimmy Carter doesn't do well. He's in the 30s. Before that, Gerald Ford is in the high 20s. Before that, Richard Nixon is in the 30s. Before that, Lyndon Johnson does pretty well. He's somewhere around 10 to the 15th best president, depending on the surveys. So there's,
wow, that's pretty interesting. I wouldn't have guessed that. But
LBJ?
With the civil rights movement, I guess.
Some of it was good and some of it was bad. By the way, this says from 815, John, you don't need a poll, spelled P-O-L-E. John, you don't need a poll, as you say, to see that Obama was a terrible president. Just look at his record. 815 says, Obama was the best president. Miss him badly. John, only American, blah, blah, blah. Oh, and by the way, about the Roomba, Steve, our other topic so far. John, I saw a picture this morning where someone's dog pooped on the floor. And that little vacuum cleaner, the Roomba, tried to go over it and then continued to vacuum the rest of the house. Well, you can imagine how that went.
Roomba.
But 414 says, hey, John, the Roomba's life-changing. We've got dogs in hardwood floors. We program the Roomba to run every day while we're at work. Saves us time and gets under the furniture. It's awesome. There's a new book out. It's about baseball. It's called For the Good of the Game. It's written by Bud Selig with Chicago's very own Phil Rogers. Selig is not a young man, but he still sounds pretty good. Just before the show, I had a chance to talk to him. Turns out he still listens to WGN.
Well, I listen to it a lot. John, nice to be with you.
For the Good of the Game. Why that title, Bud?
Well, it's something that I was taught, John, as a young man that came in a game in 1970, that in the end, any decisions that one makes have to be in the best interest of the sport. They always transcend your local interest. And so I used to talk to the club owners about that a lot, and it just seemed fitting that we make that the title of the book.
In fact, those words almost came out of the mouth of, was it the owner of the Detroit Tigers, when you had one of your first baseball meetings, and when one of the owners voted in a way that you didn't think would be in his interest, you asked him why, and he said, if it's good for baseball, it'll be good for the teams, it'll be good for the game.
That's exactly what John Fetcher said, who was the owner of the Tigers, and it's something I never forgot. He taught me very well. And by the way, the longer you're in the game, the more you understand how true that is.
This is sort of the job that you were destined to have, wasn't it?
I guess it was, although, you know, I never looked at it that way. I was stunned that my career took the turns that it did because they were unexpected. But, you know, John, the one thing I've always told people, and it's really true, if you don't have a passion for what you're doing, especially in, but in everything, then you ought not to do it. And that always stayed with me, and so I know the day I became commissioner in Chicago, as a matter of fact, I drove down by myself because I wanted to think about everything. I wanted a sort of remarkable story in so many ways, and I did.
I was a little surprised in the telling of the story, how quickly you dove into the Barry Bonds story. Talk to me about the thought process there and about your feelings.
Well, it was Phil Rogers, a Chicagoan, by the way, and as a writer, we talked about it, and it just seemed like a good way to start the book. I mean, it's nothing more complicated than that. It was a difficult situation, and sort of showed what being a commissioner meant, that you do go through some very difficult periods, and this was one, and that's why we started it.
When they think about baseball over the, I guess, your tenure, they think about some of those controversies, like the steroids era, but also they have to reflect on how the game grew, how it became fairer to teams, how it became more profitable.
Well, I'm proud of that. The revenues grew from $1.2 billion to $11 or $12 billion, but revenue sharing came in, wild card came in, interleague play came in. I mean, the game changed, and it hadn't changed, John, for 50 years, so the changes came difficult. The steroid thing was difficult, and I go into that in great detail as I'm teaching now. And I always tell my students, people seem to not to understand sometimes that it was a question. It is a matter of collective bargaining. Labor law says you have to bargain. Commissioner can't make a ruling on his own. The sport never had a drug testing program. Never had. We went through the cocaine era and never had that. So I'm comfortable the way the story went, and proud of the fact, John, that today baseball has the toughest drug testing program in America.
Are you saying that at the time you were not empowered to do more about steroids in baseball?
Oh, it was a subject of collective bargaining. I banned it in the minor leagues in 2000 for the 2001 season. That I could do unilaterally. The rest was a result of labor talks.
So the players themselves were dragging the heels on this?
Well, the Players Association was, yes, they were.
A lot of players were doing it. You think that in general it would be in the players' union's best interest to ban drugs from baseball?
Well, you would have thought so, but it wasn't that. By the way, I want to say this for the players, whom I always come to defend. There were a lot of players not doing it who wanted testing. Remember, baseball, John, had not had a testing program. We had gone through the cocaine era of the 80s, bad. Pittsburgh drug trials, 29 players convicted, 4 went to jail, and we still couldn't get a drug testing program. Hmm. So I'm proud of what we finally did.
The logic among some fans was, well, the home runs were good for the game, and therefore baseball turned a blind eye. Fans may have turned a blind eye. Heck, in Chicago, while McGuire and Sosa had that great summer, honestly, I don't remember all of us talking about the fact that the players were juiced. I don't know that we knew that.
And you're right, and you're absolutely right, and we didn't turn a blind eye. In fact, in that summer, there was a bottle of Angel discovered in McGuire's locker by a writer, Steve Wilstein of the AP. And the best we could get the union to do is go to Harvard to study it. That's the best we could do. So, but in spite of what people tell you, John, attendance went down in 99 after the McGuire-Sosa battle. And it really picked up again in 03, 04, 05, when we had a tough testing program.
I wonder why. I mean, I don't remember that statistic. I wonder if you'd asked me, I would have said that helped the game and attendance was up. I wonder what was happening in the stands then.
Well, it didn't. That's all I can tell you. So that was another historical myth, which is why I spent so much time on steroids in this book.
Are you mad today at Sosa, Bonds, McGuire, those guys?
No. No. As a matter of fact, I really liked Sammy Sosa and Mark McGuire. They were great with me, and I'm sad about what happened, and I'm sad at some of the things that happened, but I'm certainly not angry.
Attention today isn't on juiced players, it's on juiced balls. Do you think something's funny about the number of home runs being hit this year?
Well, the only thing I can tell you about that, John, there are a lot of them being hit. I mean, I can't deny it. But I've been in this game now, well, let's see, it's 55 years. And I can remember we had a tinker with the mound because the pitchers were dominating. We went to the designated hitter. I'm the only one left from that meeting in 1972 because we needed more offense. We've been back and forth on a lot of things. So I try not to get too carried away with that. Baseball is certainly looking at all that, and I have great faith that they'll address the problem and are addressing it.
Well, Justin Verlander says when you consider who owns Major League Baseball, who owns the production of baseballs, and you see a jump in it, he said it's crazy to not think that baseball isn't tinkering with the balls to hit more home runs. That's Justin Verlander.
Well, I know. I happen to like Justin a lot, but I know what he said, and I do note that other players like Max Scherzer had different things to say right after that. So, look, we're looking at it. Let me just suggest to you, in 99, after the McGuire-Sosa thing, and there were a lot of rumors, Sandy Alderson, who had been a great general manager and was, again, was ahead of my baseball operation, and he went to Haiti, and he went all over. Everybody said the balls were juiced. And the bats there was something with the bats. And we had expanded, and the pitching was lousy. There were all kinds of theories, John. But you know something? He went to Haiti, and he looked at balls, and he kept saying to me, can't find any evidence of that. So I'm going to need empirical data from somebody until I'm convinced.
It may be the guys are just trying to hit more home runs. We know about launch angles and velocities.
By the way, John, there's no doubt about that.
Yeah. What do you make of that, Bud? Do you like the game, the way it's being played offensively these days?
I do. I'm a fan at heart, as you could tell from reading the book. But like everything in life, these problems need to be addressed. And they're addressing them. And so we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, best teams win, even if the game is morphing into kind of a home run hitting contest. But there's some of us that miss the rallies. Home runs are fun, but I like a single, a double, a single, a walk. And I think that's a fun way to play the game, too.
By the way, so do I.
Well, go be commissioner again and tell him to play it.
Oh, 22 and a half years was enough time, John. That's I'm happy doing what I'm doing now.
But do you wish the game had not put the All-Star Game winner as the designator of home field advantage for the World Series?
No, I don't. And I'll tell you a story about that. The game had lost something. Players didn't want to come. They came, they were gone in a second or third inning. It wasn't what I remember. You know, I saw Ted Williams play 14 innings in Comiskey Park in 1950 with a broken elbow. And so Fox had come up with the idea, I have to tell you that. But, John, I called a couple people. I forget, we were ready to do it. The tie really had nothing to do with it. And I talked to Ron Santo and Henry Aaron. And they both said, anything you can do to put something back in the game, do it. The next year, we were in Chicago at the White Sox Park, and every player was there, all of them on both teams on the top step of the dugout at the end of the game when it ended, where Ordóñez caught a ball for the White Sox, for the American League, against the wall. But my point is, it did what we suggested. They're doing other things now, and good for them. And it's the best All-Star game, and that's what you try to preserve.
So it was the fix that they needed, but we don't necessarily need that today.
That's correct.
There's some great Chicago stories in your book. You talked about the first time Hank Aaron played at Wrigley Field.
The first time that Jackie Robinson played there.
Yeah. And the fact that they set the attendance record, 56,000 people and maybe 20,000 out at Addison and Clark.
That was the first time that Jackie Robinson played in 1947.
What a great story.
It was a wonderful story and a thrill I've never forgotten to be there.
Can you just tell me briefly about your friendship with Hank Aaron?
I can. We became friends in 1958, and it's been an extremely close relationship since then. Left Milwaukee to go to Atlanta, of course, when the team moved. But I brought him back for the last 2 years to play for the Brewers in 1975 and 6. And since then, we've just been extremely close. I was in Atlanta last Wednesday and fortunate enough to see him. He's a great player. I think the best player I've seen in my era. But he's even a better human being.
He didn't play with the flash that Willie Mays did he?
He did not. That's true.
But when you look at his statistics, who hit more home runs, had more RBIs, hit for better average, I think you could still make the case that he was the best consistent hitter in the history of the game.
I think you can, too. I agree with you. We're in complete agreement. You look at his career stats, John, they're unbelievable.
Well, that makes the Bonds thing personally painful for you then, right?
It was very difficult, no question about it.
That's Bud Selig, and he had a chance to talk to us just before the show today. By the way, he said he thinks the crop of players coming up in baseball now, or the youngsters that are in the game, it's one of the most exciting eras for baseball. He particularly noted that the White Sox have one of the best teams in that regard, just young players up and coming. And he sure had nice things to say about Javi Baez. That double play they turned yesterday at the end of the game was just, you know, if you want to know if the Cubs are back, you know, a few games in after the All-Star break, it's too soon to tell. But that looks like the team that you'd hoped you were going to see. Hitting, pitching well, playing flashy defense, the scoop from Baez to grab that ball, then the glove toss over to second base, and Addison Russell makes a quick pivot, makes a perfect throw. Good enough, right, for Rizzo to dig out of the dirt. That was just like three great plays in one to end the game. What a great game that was for the Cubs, and he has nice things to say about that team right now, too. The book is really a fun history read. It's called For the Good of the Game, Bud Selig with Chicago's Phil Rogers. 708 texted in, "Hey, John, I want Obama's respect for humanity back in the White House." We've been off and on throughout the show today talking a little bit about what the president tweeted over the weekend. And somebody said he's a much better president than Obama. We looked at some of the polls with two L's. But now I'm getting a bunch of texts about the presidents. I want Obama's respect for humanity back in the White House, John. The family had class. And by the way, the Roomba's on my list. I'm working two jobs. It would be a godsend. It's 229 on WGN. Go ahead, Steve.
We got a press release from the city about the alligator today.
Oh.
It says, "Dear members of the press, we kindly request that you stop calling Frank Robb."
Seriously?
Yeah.
Wait a minute.
It says, "Dear members of the press, we kindly request that you please stop calling Frank Robb and members of his family and allow him to focus on his work."
Oh, Frank Robb is
the new
Alligator
Bob? He's the new guy they brought in, yeah.
Now, what happened to Alligator Bob? We liked him.
We don't know.
But you know what? He wasn't getting the job done now, was he? If you're an alligator hunter, this is either one thing. This is the one thing you got to do. You got to catch alligator. He had a week he didn't get the alligator cut.
We were all trying our best.
Now, Frank Robb is in there, and Frank, you got a week. If not, we're sending Rokan in as bait. Oh, yes. 3, 2, 1. Hit it.
Sometimes I live under the moon. I thank God I'm breathing. And I pray, don't take me soon, because I am here for reasons. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it.
It's 240 on WGN. About this time, we've been asking our producers to feature a little music and tell us why they're featuring it. That's Ellis Bailiwick. Griffin did a nice job of that last week. Ashley's in the big seat today. What are we listening to, Ashley?
Right now we are listening to One Day by Modest Yahoo. And they are going to be over at the Huntington Bank Pavilion at Northerly Islands on July 21st, which is this Sunday at 6 p.m. And it's going to be a very summery, fun show because they're also going to be with Slightly Stupid, and they have a lot of, like, a weird tropical vibe.
And who's this again?
Modest Yahoo.
I know that name. He's been around for a while, right?
Yeah, I
What's
mean...
What's his real name? Isn't it like Timmy Smith?
Yeah, probably.
No, really, look it up. I think his... If we're thinking of the same person, he had a song... The person I'm thinking of had a song several years ago that was really fun and was really strange and kind of cut through. I'm trying to think of what that would have been.
It's Matthew Miller.
There you go. His real name is Matt Miller. Not bad. 242. This is WGN. 90 degrees at the lake, or 89. 90 at the airports, and 91. And no heat index to speak of, huh, Steve? It's, I guess, it is what it is. Well, that's good. I'll take this. I mean, literally, I said to Brenda over the weekend, I said, we can't complain. She says, I'm not complaining. And Brenda doesn't like hot weather like I do. But you remember May, and you remember June, and we were just cursing our bad luck every single day. And you knew eventually it would happen, but that was small consolation. And frankly, you weren't really sure it was going to happen. Well, now it's happening. 95 degrees.
My frustration, whether it's really hot or really cold, is any time it's hard to breathe outside, which with the humidity and heat, that happens. I was actually at Oak Brook Mall yesterday when you were mentioning how hot it was. You were correct. It was searing outside.
You were at Oak Brook too.
I was.
Where did you go? Did you go to Nordstrom's?
I did, Nordstrom? Actually. Yeah, I was shopping
too.
For a maid of honor dress for my sister's
smokes.
Wedding.
What time were you at Nordstrom?
Pretty much from 11 to 3:30.
We got out there around 3. You and I were at Nordstrom at the same time.
Wow, what a small world.
They had this sale up.
Oh my God, it was madness.
It was really madness. And here's what they did. They said if you are a card, if you have a Nordstrom card, you got the special sale prices. And they were pretty good prices. Brenda and I are traveling soon, and I needed to pick up a few items, so we went out there. I didn't even know the sale was on. But they then, with like yellow police tape, cordoned off areas.
Do not touch this unless you hold a Nordstrom card in your hand.
And once,
it was weird.
It was. And once, you know, it's like a gimmick. It's like, holy cow, something's going on there. Prices are so great. They've had to police tape off the great savings. So that's what they did. But once you got into the maze of yellow tape, you couldn't get out. There are people still trying to get out of Nordstrom from Sunday's shopping right now. They're just locked in there. And eventually I was like I saw a shirt I wanted. I had to walk all the way around the police tape to get it because it was in the special area.
And then like the service thing upstairs, I think on the second floor or whatever it is, they were calling numbers like a deli line because of how many people.
248.
Yes. I was very confused as to where I was for quite some time.
Did you get the dress you wanted?
I got a few, so it's really up to the bride. In the long run, right? So hopefully she likes one of them.
I'm sorry, this is a maid of honor dress?
It is, for my sister's wedding.
But doesn't the bride sort of say, hey, here's, how does that work?
She does. I'm the only one standing in the wedding, so she gave me a color palette and said I can pick what I want.
Well, that's kind of nice because now you can find something that maybe you could use in addition, right, down the road.
Yeah, to a degree. And we just also have different tastes. So it's, you know, better for both of us if we can kind of let me pick and she just either gives a thumbs up or thumbs down.
Yeah, some brides aren't that, you know, accommodating of their people or their person in your case, right? I mean, some brides are like, no, it's got to be this way. You've got to be that. Mm-hmm. Here's the dress.
It's like, well, my body shape, this looks god awful.
Yeah. The other thing is, and you don't have to share any of this with us, but the cost.
Right, that too.
You know, this happens to groomsmen. My son has been in some weddings where the guys all buy new suits rather than rent tuxedos. Renting a tux is probably cheaper, but maybe you get a new suit. But now you're getting the suit that the groom wants you to get, and you have to pay for it. And it just once you get me talking about the various and sundry expenses that come into getting married these days, you almost can't stop. It can be very pricey.
Extremely.
I hope, but it sounds like you had a nice time, huh?
I did. I got to go with my mom, so she helped me out, and the fact that I came away with something is a win.
Three, it sounds like. Then you'll bring two of them back? Is that it?
Well, so I went with two. I have other pictures of some that are runners-up if we really like those more so. But I'm hoping between the two that I did buy, she likes one of them. And if not, then they both go back.
I was taking hands full of clothes off the racks and just going into the dressing area and trying them on and then coming back out, in and out, in and out. I was literally sweating. And I thought, oh, this is bad for the next person because I'm not going to buy all these clothes. And I was really working up a little heat just going in and out, trying on 15 pair of pants, 15 shirts, et cetera, et cetera. But there were some pretty good prices at Nordstrom yesterday. They're pretty good prices today on Amazon. Or, hey, Lafka, you could shop for a wedding dress. Have you thought about that? It's Amazon Prime Day.
I guess I could. It's a little bit more risky, but why not?
According to the Chicago Tribune, and CNET has a list as well, the best things to buy on Amazon Prime today, it's their big day, and I think it's 2 days right now. I think they're doing it today and tomorrow. It says, yeah, Prime Day started at 3 a.m. Eastern Time and goes until 3 a.m. Wednesday morning. Among the deals the Tribune liked, the Amazon Echo, the Instapot Duo Plus 66-quart 9-in-1 multi-use programmable pressure cooker. I didn't know pressure cookers are still a big deal. I guess those are still hot, huh?
I think they're actually bigger than crock pots these days.
Well, crock pot is a beautiful thing. We cooked some Italian beef there, and by that I mean Brenda cooked some Italian beef there recently, and that's just a wonderful way to go. The Toshiba 43-inch Fire TV, the Lifestraw personal water filter you can get for $989. That's a 43% discount. The iRobot Roomba. I know you love your Roomba out there. The 980 robot vacuum, $549. It dropped to $549. It can make any pet owner's life easier, and it is marked down nearly 40%. 40% at $549. We have a pet, but we have hardwood floors, but we have mostly rugs on our hardwood floors, and we don't have, Daisy doesn't seem to shed. It doesn't seem to be an issue for us. The number seven is the Ring Video Doorbell. I guess you can watch. That's $69.99. The Acer Predator Helios 300 Gaming Laptop for $8.99 is number eight on their list. Number 10 is the Oral-B 7000 Smart Series Rechargeable Power Electric Toothbrush. You can get one of those things for $79.98. So for $80, you can get a rechargeable electric toothbrush.
How is a toothbrush smart, though? how do you interact with that?
Yeah, right. Let's see here. It prevents issues before they crop up, is the key to pain-free dental visits. And this toothbrush is a great tool. That's just a bunch of advertising. It doesn't say what's smart about it. It's a rechargeable toothbrush. But I do have one of those. I think they're amazing. Your teeth feel so smooth when you use them. Number 11, the Xbox One S All Digital Edition. You can get that for down to $200 if you do it right. The Black & Decker 20-volt max lithium ion drill, $44. That's a good price. When I got married, I was working at a radio station in Peoria, and shortly after I got married, I'm a brand new young man with a brand new young bride. We don't even own a house yet. We have an apartment. One of our listeners, God bless him, I don't know who he was. I've mentioned this before, though, and I'll never forget. It's just the connection to radio that some of you have and how generous listeners can be. But after I got married, some listener went out and bought a brand new electric drill, and he dropped it off at the front desk and said, "You'll thank me." And you think, what do I need an electric drill for? It's amazing how often you can use one of those things to drill or to screw or unscrew things, blah, blah, blah. Now I've got the battery-powered one. That one you had to plug in, and I used it until it broke. Number 13, the Bose SoundLeak headphones. You can get those for $159. The Apple Watch Series 3 smartwatch, save 36% today at $199. That's a pretty good price. My dad is 91 years old, and he has an Apple smartwatch. A tiny little thing on your wrist, which is a computer and all of the things that it is. He was going for a walk the other day, and he was talking to me as he was walking. And this is a guy who's 91 years old. And when we had a big debate at my house about getting Dad one of those for Christmas, because we thought it's too technically complicated, he won't be able to use it. And there he is, Dick Tracy calling Go, Go, Gomez. He's talking into his wrist as he's walking along at 91. That thing's an amazing thing. The Philips Smokeless Indoor Barbecue Grill is $15. for $42. No, you'll save $42 at checkout on Amazon Prime Day. The preferred cooking method, and also doubles as a form of entertainment as the barbecue brings friends and family together. Okay.
I love advertising. It's also an entertainment system for you.
I'm like, no, it's not. It is not that. Stop
you gonna juggle the meat for me while it's cooking, huh?
Let me just see if there's anything else. The electric shaver they got on here. The sound bars, the Bluetooth sound bars. That's a cool thing. One more. The Lumen Man smart light bulbs. Currently on sale for $21. That's a 65% savings. There's two different kinds of light bulbs on there. Those can run money these days. So a few things that are available, including the Roomba.